So as Bob mentioned in his talk, we're going to do what is now consistently a front and center activity where we try to learn from individuals in the community about experiences with treatment, experiences with prevention. So I'd like to invite Moses Augusto Rosario, as well as the panelists, if you want to start making your way up. Just a little bit about Moses. He's the Director of Treatment Education for the National Minority AIDS Council. I understand that you recently moved to D.C. and also dabbles in poetry, for those of you that don't know. And what we're going to do now is transition over to the community perspectives on user-driven HIV care. I also want to note that we did have a half hour kind of planned in there to be able to transition to our next activity, but let's go ahead and make sure that this panel has the full hour, so we'll probably eat about 15 minutes into that because we don't want to shorten any of this really important event. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm very excited about having this panel in this conference, and I also want to thank IAPAC and Jose that always keep in mind the importance of the point of view and the perspective of those individuals living with HIV that not only are here to share their life experience about how is it to live with HIV, but also these are individuals that they use their own experience and skills to help other people with HIV in the community. So that's one of the, that it's kind of the aspect that I want to highlight is how transformative has been for people with HIV to get involved in the field and being active and participate and add value to any of the activities and responses that we do to forward the well-being of people living with HIV. My name is Moises Augusto. I'm the Director of Treatment for the National Minority AIDS Council. This spring, it was 30 years of me living with HIV, and it has been quite a ride. I wanted to talk a little bit very briefly about how important it has been for me to get involved in the response to HIV. I found out I was positive in 1986 in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and at that time, the prognosis that I was given was that I was going to live for 6 months, that I had to do exercise, and that's it. So for me, I mean, the first week was difficult, but then after a while, I found a book in a bookstore called Living with AIDS, and that was my Bible for that decade. When I decided to go to graduate school, I went to New York, got care. ACT was just starting, I don't know, it was approved in 87. So in 88, I went to do graduate school in New York. And I ran into a group called ACT UP of activists, and that involvement changed my whole life. I joined a group of young individuals like my age that they decided to fight back. They decided to educate themselves and become knowledgeable activists on a variety of issues. One of the committees was treatment issues, and that was one of the committees that got my attention and I got involved. And quickly I learned that if I wanted to survive this disease, I needed to be knowledgeable about the science of HIV. And that I had to, as Bob mentioned, make sure that I build partnerships with my doctors and not being just a passive patient. But the experience of being a person with HIV, trying to find my way in the healthcare system, trying to find my way in life at that age, helped me to develop skills that I knew immediately that were going to be useful for other people living with HIV. And I dropped graduate school, and I just went full force working on HIV until this moment. So I want to, as you all know, and this is like preaching to the choir, the response to AIDS has been very powerful, and I strongly believe that it has to do also with the involvement of people living with HIV, leading the agenda of the response to HIV, and that these individuals with HIV, from the very beginning, ACT UP, the People with AIDS Coalition, Body Positive, were groups that gave form to the agenda of activism and advocacy. And one of the things that I think is that we have treatments because the strong activism that happened with groups like Treatment Action Group, with active treatment and data committee, individuals that were treatment advocates and then sat at the table with the researchers at the ACTG meetings, then at the community constituency group, which I'm honored I was part of that effort too. So today we have three fierce activists and three persons living with HIV that are here to share with you their experiences. And they're here to inspire you, but also they are here to teach you something about what are the things that they do in the community, you know, and what is the experience as a person living with HIV that you have to manage your own health, that you have to, you know, be aware of that, giving that out to others and working with others living with HIV as they themselves are living with HIV. And it's not a lot of people lately, and this is something that they want to be politically correct about engaging PWAs in their advisory board, but it's not only because they have a virus. There are skills and human experience to share. So I think I'm going to let them introduce yourself. We're going to start with Darius. If you tell us your name, where you come from, and the same, we'll go with Latricia and Joey. Do you want to come here? Mm-hmm.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Darius Massey. I'm 22 years old. I'm currently from Bradenton, Florida, and been living here in Miami for a little over a year.
I'm Latricia Miles. I'm employed at Kansas City Care Clinic. I have been on this journey for 20 years, and you will hear from me shortly.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to sunny South Florida. I'm one of the local guys here. My name's Joey Nguyen. I'm the Community Relations Director at EmpowerU, a local federally qualified health center in Miami, and I've been living with HIV since 1987. I've been working in the field for over 25 years.
So we're going to start our panel with a presentation for Latricia, and I wanted to ask if Jonathan got her slides to be projected here. Oh, it's up there? Okay, great. Thank you. I can't see from here. Okay, so Latricia, please.
Good morning again. Well, that was pretty weak. I know that I'm in between a light breakfast and I'm a couple of hours before lunch, so I'm really not impeding anyone from their food. So I'll say it again, good morning.
Good morning.
That sounds much better. Well, I want to talk about three different areas of adherence from a community perspective. Where putting us in the driver's seat certainly can be significant. As I said, I've been driving this for about 20 years, so I'll tell you that you are safe with me. I want to first speak from adherence, mostly from a women's perspective. Then I'll speak about the importance of peer education and how my clinic works with peer educators, and then the barriers and improving care. So, our first slide. Women of color, especially African American women, currently represent the majority among women living with HIV/AIDS, and this is according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so we face a lot of social and economic factors that both increase our vulnerability to HIV and decrease our access. When we look at violence and trauma, of which I'll talk about in some detail in the presentation, is a predictor of these facts. So the negative outcomes are largely due to the inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources, and they highlight the need for greater social and economic empowerment of women. So among the 1.1 to 1.2 people living with HIV in the United States, 25% of those are women. And so when you look at the disparities there, about 80% of women living with HIV are women of color. When you talk about the violence and trauma at your own agencies, hopefully, this speaks to the widening gap of inequalities for women of color. So women living with HIV are 5 times more likely to experience post-traumatic stress and twice as likely to be a victim of intimate partner violence. So women living with HIV with a recent trauma are 4 times more likely to experience treatment failure. Next. So when you look at the intersections, there are multiple factors that influence women's experiences living with HIV. There are many different intersections there. Race, ethnicity, religion, education, and occupation. And when you look at specifically education and occupation, what we think about is there is a lot of emphasis put, of course, on healthcare, and there should be. But sometimes we ignore the human services aspect of care. And so integrating a more comprehensive service for women, such as providing training, is paramount for women. Because when you look at work in itself, what that can provide for women, financial security, social status, personal development, social relations, and it improves the self-esteem for women. Next. An HIV diagnosis, it can push women into poverty. And so that little slide, but I also know that this woman actually has control over what ultimately is a life or death decision with the stroke of her pen, and clearly she is in a bad mood. What I have is a very expensive medical condition and no way to pay for it. It is that simple. I need your help. So we as women living with HIV are driven into poverty and hell there, and we are drowning. So poverty does or may lead to HIV because we're talking about women who are poor and may not have stable housing, may also have less power to negotiate safer sex in relationships, putting them at increased risk of intimate partner violence, not to speak of the programs in itself, like the ADAP programs and some of our medical services that require us to have a specific amount of money annually to qualify for benefits. So you have that income ineligible gap there. And so that means that HIV-positive women have to keep their income under a certain level in order to maintain access to life-extending medications. Next. So looking at those barriers, Positive Women's Network facilitated a community-based research project, and it was led by women that were HIV-positive. It involved about 180 women living with HIV in 7 different demographic areas. And so those women identified some of the top eight for them: transportation, 25%, UC case management, connection with other women living with HIV, access to HIV specialists. They also mentioned evening and weekend. They were referring to the clinic hours. If you're working a full-time job and you're getting off at 5, those clinic hours are not extended, so that's a barrier. Other things that were mentioned were substance abuse, too busy, lack of education, and insurance, and then paying for medications. Next. So improving adherence means improving care. So what are some of those priorities that we want to look at? Peer-based programs and support groups definitely reduce isolation, and they provide hope and inspiration. They also support treatment adherence. Services that reduce financial and logistical barriers to care. So again, we're talking about transportation. Interventions that prevent, that promote healing from trauma. Implementing those at your agencies and clinics and talking about those. Meaningful involvement of impacted communities and care delivery, and that's being culturally relevant. Stigma reduction and interventions. So I'd like to talk just briefly about peers. Peers, as we describe them at our clinic, are persons that are living with HIV. They share some key characteristics, and sometimes you do have that gray area because they are part of the community, they serve that community, and they're part of the care community as well. They share experiences. They are trusted educators and role models. Next. What peers do, and again, I'm being a little bit more specific to KC Care, we promote adherence as far as keeping appointments, providing social support, being culturally linguistically appropriate. And then we do what we call just-in-time sessions. And so if doctors or our prevention specialists or our testing folks has a person with HIV that's newly diagnosed or has problems with adherence, we put a HIV-positive person there as a person that can address that situation, and we call it just in time. And they also provide reminder calls. Next. Here's a chart, and it's a little bit dated, but we feel that it is still depictive of what is existing today. And I'll just speak to a couple of them. And on the left side, you'll see those clients that do not have peers, and then on the other side, if there is a peer involved. So 49% of the folks that did not have a peer had missed appointments, as opposed to 74% of folks that did have a peer did not miss any appointments. And then when you go to the very last one, when you're seeing your doctor and you're adherent, 40% of the folks that did not have a peer were not adherent to the antiretrovirals, as opposed to 58%. Next. So a peer is or should be integrated into the entire healthcare team. Kansas City Care, we are one of the largest in the area with over 600 patients. We have case management, and that includes family, youth, linkage, and we have behavioral health, which includes substance abuse and mental health. Next. How does it work? Well, peers are members of the multidisciplinary team. So they are sitting at the table with the doctors, with the case managers and nurses, and they are they have the ability to give their input just as another discipline at the table. They also have access to all medical records that case managers can access to. We are also on the same database that case managers are on. And so this gives a lot of legitimacy to the program because case managers can look at the same information for peers and what we're doing and working with clients. Next. Training and support. Our peers get about 32 hours of training, 2 weeks on the job, job shadowing. They have a first-line supervisor, which is myself, And there is a LMSW, which is my manager. They also participate in Rhine-wide Planning Council. Our peers are expected to be visible in the community, as well as facilitating trainings. Next. Integrating peers into the entire spectrum means that the recruitment, the hiring, the retention, everything is coming out of human resources, just like every other employee. It's nothing totally separate for a peer as opposed to someone else at the clinic. There is, of course, a job description. There's two types of orientation, an orientation for the clinic and an orientation for the peers themselves, so that they get HIV disease education. Compensation, the peers are full-time, and they are hourly employees, and they earn benefits like sick time as well as vacation. Next. Successful implementation of a peer program, of course, you have to have buy-in. You have to have an adequate compensation package. Long are the days that we're asking peers and folks that are HIV positive to continue to do work at no pay. That's not equitable. Next. I have a peer advocacy. This was an 18-year-old that I had worked with. She was newly diagnosed. She had limited support from her mother. She supported her from a distance, and her mother was afraid and ashamed of her HIV status. She tried different medications. She went to a couple of doctors who put her on the same regimen. She was extremely active, and she experienced a lot of side effects. But the message for her, she said that the peer, which was me at the time, told her that she could not quit. She had a CD4 of about 2. Had several hospitalizations, and she struggled with some mental instability. But at this point, I am proud to say that she is virally suppressed. She's headed to becoming undetectable, but this young lady had a difficult struggle. Next. And how am I doing with time? Okay. All right. Thank you. Understanding the impact of trauma and violence on women living with HIV, 55% of women have experienced intimate partner violence. 61% have experienced a lifetime of sexual abuse. 30% have had a recent PTSD experience. Next. And so when you look at the impact of trauma across the care continuum, you can see some of the statistics. Intimate partner violence and recent trauma, they're 3 times more likely to delay linkage to care. Half of them are as likely to be on antiretrovirals. There's virologic failure. And then lifetime trauma, there's a significant association of numbers of lifetime traumas and antiretroviral non-adherence. So you look at the trauma-informed primary care, and this is primarily to speak to trying to implement trauma-informed care at our agencies and really take this seriously. Next. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. User-driven care, I had to look it up. So I was like, oh, okay, that's what you call it. It's a new insight and a new paradigm for healthcare to come up with better outcomes, because if the person that's getting the treatment isn't invested in it and isn't aware of their part of the bargain, it doesn't do as well as if people aren't engaged and aren't actualized in what they're doing. Like, if I don't get why I'm doing this, I'm less likely to do what I need to do to keep myself healthy. So I like to talk to providers, as a person living with HIV, about context. And I tell them about what I do. My day job, I'm a community relations director, but I'm also the guy that deals with the trouble cases in the clinic when they're misbehaving or not getting the program, or someone didn't give them the support they needed to have the right strategy to be successful. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my role, and my role is above and beyond the agency that I work at. I'm the co-chair of Florida's HIV/AIDS Advocacy Network. It's a statewide network that talks about provider networks and educating both providers and clients about the issues surrounding HIV care. So that's a very big role, and I get the opportunity to go around the state and work with a variety of different stakeholders and agencies. And I also speak for some pharmaceutical companies, and I do a lot of non-branded presentations about client engagement. Shout out to Allison and Merck, because I think they have a great chat series that talks about client engagement and client empowerment. And that's my passion in all of this. Because I've worked in hospitals, I've worked in clinics, I've worked in substance abuse rehab centers. I'm a little bit older than you probably think. I worked in Medicaid programs for disease management. I've worked at the health department. I've worked in federally qualified health centers. So I've kind of seen all the different aspects of healthcare, and I see trends across all of them that where we're missing the most important part, and that's the client engagement. And I always say to clients, you know, doctors have 15 to 20 minutes. They got 18 people in the waiting room. Somebody's out sick. There's a nurse not here. We're dealing with this other thing that's going on. They don't give you the amount of time that in an ideal world we could have to be able to have a real meaningful conversation and really engage people. And that's why it's so critical for clinicians to value their allied health professionals. The rest of the team does a lot of that time-consuming and time-intensive work with clients. So I always say the doctor is the singer, but the rest of the staff are the lights and the seats and the music and the orchestra and everything else that makes the performance do what it does. So my role is to empower clients to engage in their healthcare. And there's this little experience that I tell people, and I find it fascinating because it's an aha moment for some people. When you go get your haircut, you're very prescriptive in what you're expecting. Very clear expectations. This is how I want it done. It's usually a big deal. You usually don't do it on a whim. And so you have very clear expectations. And you communicate that really well, don't you? Do you? Yes? No? Let's see. Sign of hands. How many people are very prescriptive in how they want their hair done? My apologies to those of you that are hair challenged. But for the majority of folks, it's a real issue. When you go to a special dinner, especially if it's, you know, with family or loved ones or friends you haven't seen in a while, and you go somewhere special, you're very prescriptive to the waiter, right? This is how I want it prepared. This is what I want to drink. And you have clear expectations about what you want to eat. Am I right? How many of you agree and are a little bossy with your waiters? So now we talk about the most important thing of all, and that's your personal health care. And most of the clients just shut down. Yes, doctor. Yes, nurse. Just keep nodding my head until I can get out of here. Okay. Uh-huh. Yes. Mm-hmm. So part of our challenge is to encourage and empower clients to be open and honest and communicative, and to teach the clinical staff how to listen better and how to ask in different ways. Because our doctors always get frustrated when they come out and they say, this and this and this. And I'm like, no, hold on. Let me go talk to them. And then I come in and I go, here's what you're missing. They didn't say this. They didn't tell you that. And they're like, well, how come when you ask, they say this? And when I ask, they say that. And I'm like, you have to ask a couple of different ways sometimes. And you have to have the body language that says, I'm listening to you. I'm listening to who you are. I'm listening to where you are. I know your home situation. And I know sometimes it's impossible for the prescriber to do that, but that's where the rest of the allied health team comes into play. You should always know the living situation of every client you have. Whether it's someone that works and travels all the time, whether it's someone that never leaves the house, if it's someone that no one else in the house knows they're positive, if it's someone that's got lots of kids in the house, somebody that's got nobody in the house, that all those pieces impact the strategies for adherence. It's very, very critical. And that's something I learned in our disease management program here in Florida that was specific to HIV, was the home setting is a good indicator of how prepared they are to deal with issues of adherence. And I'm fair, I teach people about their responsibilities. Make your appointments. If you can't, call and say, I can't. They're not going to bite your head off. They'd rather know a day ahead and get an emergency slot filled than have a no-show and nobody to fill that slot. And I talk about paperwork and keeping stuff. You don't have to understand what it is, but keep it all in one folder. And I talk about the responsibility of getting in care, getting on therapy, and getting to undetectable. That's our responsibility as people living with HIV. Because if we could get everybody that was positive to be on therapy and undetectable, we would do a gigantic leap forward in ending new infections. And I always say ending new infections, because ending AIDS means the last person with HIV is gone. So I'd rather be inclusive and say end new infections, because that includes me in part of the strategy of how do we move forward to reduce these infections to zero. So that's my little pet peeve. I'll put that out there up front. The next thing, and this is one that most everybody misses until they get that aha moment, clients have to have their reason for living. And I'm not esoteric. It doesn't have to be. It's got to be for them. If it's got to be so your grandchild, you see him graduate from high school, I'll take that. Whatever it is that they have an aspiration to do or to see, that's the value. There's got to be a reason for living. Because from outside of the healthcare industry, you're making me go to appointments, fill out paperwork, go do eligibility, go do insurance re-enrollment, fill out this paperwork, go wait in this room, go take blood. Sometimes we don't have the greatest phlebotomists, and it's a painful situation, and I got to come back again in 3 months or 4 months or 6 months. Oh, and by the way, your eligibility expired, so I need you to go down the hall and do the paperwork again that you just did 2 weeks ago over at that other agency, because that's a different funding stream. Healthcare is a challenge. Like I say to my clients, healthcare is like the Olympics, and you've got to jump these hurdles, and you got to beat everybody else, and you got to get a medal if you're going to come back next time. Healthcare is a challenge, and I know we like to think ours is wonderful and warm and fuzzy and easy, but when you step back and you look at the systems of care, they are barriers for people living with HIV. So that's something I always make painfully aware to all this. I know everyone in medical that's ever worked with me probably either says they love me or I drove them crazy. But I'm constantly reaffirming context. For someone who all the rest of my day has nothing to do with my healthcare, this interrupts my daily cycle. And you all know healthcare is crazy. The paperwork, pre-authorization, filling out forms, going from here to there, waiting rooms. It is the reality, and I tell them, okay, you're an adult. We have to be an adult. We have to play this game because you want to stick around, right? So the essence of why am I so successful, and you got me beat, I'm only 29 years, but why am I so successful at what I do, and why do I miss so few doses? Because I want to stick around to help change this. And this is the healthcare system. My partner died in a very uncaring, awful healthcare system in New York back in the 80s. And I don't want that to keep happening. It happens here in Florida all the time. And everyone can improve. No matter how many accolades you have, no matter how much education, we can all learn. We are here to learn. That's what human beings do. We learn to do things better, smarter, faster. And for you all, I challenge you to be more compassionate because people are not perfect. I encourage them to be honest. I encourage them to communicate. And I tell them, look, the doctor's only as good as the puzzle he sees in front of him or her. And I try not to say doctor prescribers because in our clinic, we've got physician's assistants and nurse practitioners, and we've got all kinds of folks that are helping keep people healthy. So let me correct myself there. But I say the healthcare team is looking at a puzzle. And if you're hiding a couple of pieces, that might be a pony, that might be a balloon, I'm going to go somewhere in between. The more information you give to your healthcare team, the more accurate is the picture that they see and the reality. And I know it's hard for you to talk about sex and drugs, so that's on your side. You got to learn, do you use drugs? Because then at least you know where you are. And let me tell you, some of our most adherent clients are the ones that are former heroin users because they get PK levels like no one else. Personal experience, they know what a PK level is. So the other half of my job is about providing insight to the clinical team. Your part in making this a success. I don't like talking about adherence as in, you know, you don't want to fail. I want to say the goal is to miss the fewest doses possible. Because, again, we're all human beings, and we are all going to miss some doses. And I don't want any stigma or stress around, I missed the dose. As long as we learn from it, or it was something like, you know, oh, my flight got delayed. I ended at that wonderful airline whose name shall remain nameless that said, oh, you're on your own. We can get you on a flight at 6 a.m. And it's like, Okay, well, that was when I learned always keep 2 extra days worth of meds with me when I travel. Lesson? Okay, I got it. But I didn't beat myself up for, oh my God, I'm going to miss a day. Because I'm pretty OCD. I swear by pill boxes. I miss a handful of doses a year, if that. I went 1 year with only one missed dose. But it's about how you frame things. It's about context when you're treating people. We are not just a number. We are not just another person to take your favorite therapy. We are a puzzle. We've got pieces that should dictate what's out. You know, you got 27 different therapies out there. Once I tell you everything and what I've done and my genotype, that knocks out all but 3 or 4. You need to talk to me a little more and get me engaged in it. Because if I'm aware and I feel like I helped make this decision, I'm much more likely to stick it out during the rough times. And this is one of my last points for prescribers. You need to learn how to ask about side effects a little more thoroughly. That's the number one thing that I usually get out of a client that a prescriber doesn't get. Because if you just say, you're not having any side effects, are you? No. And then I go on and go, how many times a week do you have diarrhea? Oh my God, 3-4 times a day. I've had to quit my job because of it. Oh, the doctor thinks you're not having any side effects. Well, I didn't want to upset him. We have to learn how to ask differently. Be careful how you ask questions. Just like Medicaid and Medicare coverage. The number one thing to ask if they have Medicare is, do you have the little paper red, white, and blue card? Oh, I got that. Do you have Medicare coverage? No, that's for old people. You have to ask in different ways because everybody's not where you are in terms of health literacy or age or where you came from in the country or your life background. Sometimes we have to probe. Ask in different ways. I'm constantly pushing healthcare providers to improve their worldview because some people are on drugs. Some people have to be sex workers. Some people have a busy life and they don't understand and value the abstract concept of, I feel fine right now. This isn't going to happen to me for a long time. Or, I see Joey Wynn and he's been HIV positive since before I was born. You know, I don't have to worry about this. And then it's my responsibility to go in and say, but I do everything I'm supposed to do. I take my pills, I go to the doctor, I torture my poor doctor. Dr. Beal, bless his heart. I'm a very demanding client. And sometimes I think you need a demanding client to keep you on your toes. Because I finally found out that they, for 30 minutes before I get there, they're all together in the case conferencing, oh my God, he's coming in, we're doing this and that. I think all of you need one of those patients to keep you on your toes because I have never been a, yes, okay, mm-hmm. I've had some great doctors in my time. Get involved. That's another thing that I noticed, that if I could fix one thing in the healthcare system, a lot of prescribers don't understand the sometimes boring, sometimes ugly politics of the HIV financing. You know, they write a script, here you go. Well, that's not on the formulary for what I can get, so they're not going to give me that. So what do I do next? Deal with the nurse. You need to get involved because this stuff is expensive. That's a whole nother conference, I think, about drug pricing. But you've got to understand the difficulties, and it's not easy to fix things. Yeah, you understand the theoretical, intellectual, this client needs this drug. Yeah, okay, well, we're not in a perfect world here in the United States, and we have to do pressure. And sometimes a prescriber giving testimony does tremendous work for people that aren't listening to the message, the heartstring message. They want to hear something different. And we have too few providers that are involved in the advocacy and the policy work that needs to be done. I'm almost done. I do want to, because people often say I'm hard on industry, I want to give a quick shout out because, again, Merck's chat series does a great job in terms of client empowerment and engagement. It's non-branded, doesn't talk about drugs. It really is a great tool to have a conversation about client engagement and empowerment. Veeve has an annual meeting that talks about the funded projects they do with agencies all over the world, and as well as information education for clients and advocates. I think that's a best in class. Janssen has lots of special projects they fund that aren't necessarily big giant agencies with grant writers, but are really targeted special projects that have huge impact and opportunities to replicate. So industry does have some great resources that we need to tap into more. I think it's the folks with grant writers that usually are the ones that jump on all that stuff. But we have to do a better job with our clinics and with our medical teams to say, What else is out there to help us? Because we get too complacent with people falling through the cracks. That really flips me out when I find them. So we need to be more aware. I know we're all busy. We have tons of clients. We have tons of work. It's like, oh, my God. And then you put the internet on top of it. It's like, I can't keep up. But we've got to be aware. And I think as a person living with HIV, that's what I do with the clinicians that I interact with, is make them painfully aware of we are human beings with a plethora of issues, barriers, dramas, problems. And we need more compassion in the system. Thank you very much.
Good morning again. I do apologize. I'm extremely nervous. Never done this before. But my journey began March 2015. I was diagnosed with HIV then, and I started treatment in April in 2015 as well. When I was diagnosed, I was completely lost, no knowledge of too much about the virus, and was not sure where to get treatment, where to get help or anything like that. Didn't know who to speak with, didn't know who to talk to. It was just completely completely lost and very unknowledgeable about the situation. As time went on, I became undetectable in August of 2015. When I was diagnosed, I definitely was completely concerned with what my life would be like in the future. I wanted to know if I can have children. I wanted to know if I'd be able to tell my parents. I wanted to know if I was... you're going to be looked at any differently, because I've never met or encountered anyone that was affected by HIV up until, well, 20 years old, and it was only one person, and definitely was a shocker for me then. But as time went on, living here in Miami, I was introduced to a gay social group called Black Brothers Living Authentically Creating Change. It's like a community outreach. We've done breast cancer walks, AIDS walks, fed the homeless, you know, done so many different things in the community. With that, I've met so many different people that are also advocates for HIV and the gay community as well. Have experienced a lot of different things and learned a lot as time has gone on. So from that, I, for a while, was pretty quiet about my status. Didn't want to express it to anyone. Wasn't quite sure how it would be taken with living with HIV and not necessarily knowing that if there's anyone else in my, you know, peer group that was able to I guess understand what I was going through, because I'm not sure they were living with it or not. But like I said, as time has gone on, I've learned a lot about it. I've learned many different people within the group, many different people that I've met along the way that have been affected by it as well. Able to have a personal connection with them and kind of compare stories on how they were affected from the day they were affected to up until now. Living here in Miami-Dade and Broward County, living in the county, that two counties that are number one in the state, of course, being, you know, with that, I've learned a lot, again, I say. There's definitely a lot of resources, a lot of different things that I have learned from, a lot of different things that are soon to come from that information. But if I were living back where I'm from, a lot of things that I've dealt with today and I've learned from, I don't think I would have had the same knowledge with living here. I have a great relationship with my doctor. I love going to the doctor. I have a nurse there that I have a great relationship with. I'm able to talk and laugh and joke and also get the information that I need, also give personal experiences on the things that I've dealt with as far as my treatment or anything like that. As far as the treatment has gone, I haven't actually had any side effects. I'm very thankful for that. I remember a few weeks ago, I received a phone call from my mother, and she was saying that she noticed I had gained weight, and she wanted to know if there was anything wrong with me. And I said, I'm perfectly fine. To this day, I have to explain to her, from the day that I found out and up until now, I haven't actually felt any different. Nothing has changed other than my mental state and my knowledge on the virus. Ryan White and the insurance and things like that have come along with the treatment. Learned a lot with that. And I was able to find out how much my pills were, $1,400, I believe, per bottle. definitely something I would not be able to afford on a monthly basis or even annually basis at all. Definitely thankful for all the resources that I do have and the insurance and things like that to help me along the way. I know that it's affected by a lot of people are affected by it. And I do also wonder if it was to come out of someone's pocket or people were having to pay for it monthly, how would the world really be as far as the treatment were going, as far as the treatment would be going? I've met a lot of people along the way, established some personal relationships. Not all negative, some are positive. I'm able to speak here today. I've never in my life would imagine I would ever be able to do anything like that at all. And with this experience, I'm definitely going to absorb all the knowledge I can get. And of course, again, establishing better relationships with people, being able to network and talk more about and get more involved on the statistics and in how the community really works as far as the virus goes. So, I'm definitely honored with being here, and I thank you.
That was great, all of them. So I want to thank you guys. You did amazing. It's 11 o'clock. I don't know if we could have a couple of minutes if you have any question for them. Yeah? Okay. So is there any question?
No problem. Thank you. I would say one thing that did work, I was able to pay attention to my health, watch what I was eating, exercising, paying attention to that, because along with the virus, I've also was diagnosed, having eczema. So it's a lot of it's pretty, I guess you can say, important that I just pay attention to that. Any negatives that came with it? None that I can really think of. I mean, other than, the mental being nervous or being ashamed, in the sense of being ashamed with having everything like that. But everything has worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the day I was diagnosed, I actually went to urgent care for another reason. And while I was there, I decided to get tested. A week later, I got my results back, and the doctor just came in and he asked me if I was okay. And I said, yeah, I'm fine. And he just kind of dropped the bomb, and I was completely in shock. I started hyperventilating. My whole body just became numb. So it was definitely, at that moment, I just said to myself, my life will never be the same. I didn't cry then, but it was the next day I went to the AHF health clinic in downtown Fort Lauderdale, was able to get more treatment or, I guess, get more knowledge. I was retested then, and with the nurse being there, I was able to get more of a personal feel from them. From the first place I went to, I'm not saying they were doing a bad job, but it was two different things. The nurse at the AHF Foundation definitely, without even knowing, gave me this, warmth. I was definitely able to just relax at that moment. And even with the doctors, or the doctor that I do have now, I guess since I'm able to deal with it, I don't get too upset about it. Or even at the moment, I was upset because I wasn't sure. I tell people all the time, I was just a little lost. So that's why I didn't know what was going to happen. That's why I was upset. So.
Longer working with different groups and clinics. How do you share your experience
I've been at my current job for a little over 2.5 years, and we have 4,500 patients. That's both a blessing and a curse all at once. And I think part of the extreme success that we've had, and this is difficult, is the people that work there are from those neighborhoods. The people go to the same churches as the clients that fell out of care, and they're able to interact with them and say, hey, we haven't seen you in a while, and, you know, show up. Our peers grew up in those neighborhoods. We've got a lot of staff that are from the community that they're serving. I know sometimes that's hard, especially if it's a mobile clinic or if it's pulling people from big cities to go to rural areas. But I truly believe the most success we've had are our peer navigators who know everybody in the community or know of them, are able to really go out and figure out a way to connect with people and send a subtle message, we need you to come back. But it's the biggest challenge of all. That 10-10-10 is going to take more resources and time and energy than the 90-90-90, in my perspective.
Right.
It's been a journey for me. 20 years is a long time, but I didn't start out like that. Definitely, when I started, the first 3 years of my diagnosis was a lot of depression, isolation. Definitely thought I was the only woman living with HIV. That sounds silly, but when you don't know, you don't know. I understand. And we have a lot of first visits with our clients at the clinic. My peer team staff is a part of that. So when they first come to the clinic for their first visit, a peer is there to meet them. A lot of times they really don't want anyone to talk about HIV, because remember, if you don't talk about it, it's not happening. If I show up at the clinic, that's another indicator too, I'm sick. And so whether they call me the HIV lady or not, I'm on the scene. I am there when they come in. One young lady comes to mind. I would stick my head in when she would come for her visits, and you know, she would acknowledge me, and I would say, well, yeah, you remember me. I was, you know, here last time when you came to visit. If you don't mind, I'd just like to stop in every now and then. I'll call you every now and then. And she was okay with that. I think I surprised her a lot of times. But I did this with this young lady probably for 5 years, stepping in and out of her life, sometimes very situational. One day I called her because we were having a women's group, and I said, you know, we're having this great group. I think you'll be great for it. Will you come? She said, yes. I almost dropped the phone. This was 5 years of chasing this lady. But she came to the meeting. She said, I'm going through some life changes now. A lot of things are changing for me. And because of that, she, you know, is more involved in her care. And right now she is on my staff as a peer educator. And so that tenacity, you know, we go after these clients, don't we? Because we want them to experience and have some of the same benefits that we have. We're not saying that we're perfect, but there are some things that we've done right, having lived with this for 20 years.
Right. Yes.
We do. As a clinic, we don't. We usually send our perinatally infected women to Truman Medical Center. So we don't have a huge number of women in general at our clinic. We have a family case manager that works with the women, and she works very closely with them coming to their medical visits. I've worked with probably about 5 pregnant women, and so I call them my babies. So all of those babies are HIV negative, and just continuing to encourage them. The very first one that I worked with, She was contemplating whether she should abort or whether she should keep the child. And what really helped her was the education, because she had a lack of knowledge as to what this all meant. She got the news that she was pregnant and the news of being HIV positive, all in the same thing. And so how do you deal with that? Of course, I could not make a decision for her, but giving her the facts helped her to make that decision. And he is now in first grade.
Hello.
Oh, sorry.
I have very limited experience with that. I've only interacted twice. We were fortunate that it was really big screen, and I don't know where they were, but they also had a big screen, so it was almost like we were sitting in the same room together. You do have to be a little more charismatic and a little more emphatic and really connect and a lot more. It's a little bit more difficult, but I think... as technology improves and as people get more technology in more places, that it's a wave of the future for rural health, I think, because just the operational logistics of trying to get care to everybody everywhere, we're going to have to do. And I think younger people are so much more comfortable with technology that I think that it won't be as difficult as it is with older generations that kind of are not as experienced with technology. But that's a great question, but I don't have a lot of experience with it.
I agree. I just think that, you know, we've got to look at different ways of delivering services, and telemedicine is one of those. So, and I don't have a lot of experience in it.
Great. The question is about people that live in rural areas. It's related to patients that live in rural areas that have to fill up a lot of papers, and they will need some support. He wants to get some insight about how you work with the person that is in that situation.
I almost always, when we relocate people, it's almost always to another big city. I only did once. Am I allowed to? There is a company that provided a software called the Case Management Portal Virology, and they, like, I plug in the city, and then I find out who's an AIDS service organization or the FQHC in that area, and then we connect that way, and then we find out what they need and if there are wait lists, or there's usually, we give this, and they have that. And so we have a conversation with the client about it. It's transitioning, just like when you're moving. You got to figure out all kinds of things. We really try. And then sometimes the client goes, oh, I can't go there because if they don't have this, this, and this, what am I going to do? So that's a really hard situation. That's another one that it's difficult. And I normally send from one big city in Miami to another big city like Atlanta or L.A. or somewhere else. Only once did we, and they like had next to nothing other than primary care, and it was like, well, you're going to have to figure out how to do everything else some other way, because they just didn't have the resources, and they weren't in a Ryan White Parday city, and they didn't have a lot of resources, So that's a huge challenge that we tell clients to be aware of if you're going to move. It's okay to move, but be aware of, you know, your living situation, the healthcare resources, and then transportation.
Okay, we have one more minute left.
Hi, I would like to take that minute, please.
Okay.
My name is Alize Johnson. I'm the treatment adherence nurse for an outpatient clinic in Syracuse, New York. And I just wanted to personally come up here and take time to say thank you and to say how valuable you guys are sitting up there and just advocating and speaking on so many important topics. And also to the last speaker, you said it was your first time, and you did absolutely amazing.
Yes.
And I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you.
I wanted to just commend you for your courage and just encourage you to continue to be in the forefront, because we all know that the population that is disproportionately affected is our young Black MSM men. So just make sure you stay encouraged and tell your story, because it's powerful, and that's why we're here, to help one another. So I just want to say again, thank you so much, and encourage everybody in this conference to use this mic, because when you're asking questions, it's really helpful if we all can hear. And thank you for the people who set it up, the hard work that it takes to set this stuff up. So come on, let's use it, guys.
That was nice. Okay, well, thank you very much, and have a good lunch.